Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Ron McKeefrey. This is episode number 293. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Truly appreciate those of you that like, share, comment, jump on the Instagram live now. Make sure you put your questions below. We're trying to get to as many of those as we can as well, but also want to thank our partner for this year, for 2018. It's just Train Heroic, you know, and we wanted to go only with Train Heroic just because we're going to be doing so much with them with the way that we put out our Play Alliance program with our remote coaching and our consulting and customization and things along those lines. So if you're not following Train Heroic, please jump over to their page and like their page. Just some great guys doing some great things and good friends of mine as well. So check them out as well. This week I'm joined by Matt Whitty. Matt is hard to explain to you, man. You're podcaster, entrepreneur, a strength athlete, three world records. You got a gym. You build equipment. I mean, you can do a little bit of everything, man. How would you describe you?
Yeah, I mean, just jack of all trades. I mean, you know, some people that's seen or read some of my stuff probably realize. I mean, I came from the gutter. I was turned down to go to school. My grades in high school were shit. I applied to go to Ball State, which I eventually got a master's from, but initially they rejected me due to my high school grades. And at the time I didn't realize a lot of the high school struggles were my dad passed away right when I started my freshman year and didn't really know how to deal with a lot of that. So my focus turned into going over to the gym and met three or four guys that were like father figures to me. And one of them was Tim Smith. And Tim Smith was a 500-pound raw bencher at 185. And so as a 13-year-old kid, I walk in and see a guy at 185 pounds benching five plates on each side. So I was automatically desensitized to what heavy and light was. All I knew was this guy weighed as much as I did in seventh grade and could fucking bench five plates. So I wanted to be him. I wanted to be the strongest guy at the Y, which at my YMCA was a tall order. But by the time I was, you know, 18, 19, I was already stepping on his foot already, you know, knocking at his door. I picked it up real fast, but a lot of my focus and my reading and my initial passion came in the weight training. And so when I initially applied for school and got rejected, the reason that I applied for school in the first place is I went and talked with the head strength coach at the Colts at the time. His name was John Torrine. Yeah, he's awesome. And John Torrine told me, he goes, you know, if you want a job like mine, you're going to have to get a master's and you're going to have to go back to school. And at that time, I thought, you know, at 17, 18, I could just be a big, strong kid and get in somewhere and do that. I didn't have any idea of being from a small city and school that, you know, the only strength coach in town was Wade Russell at Ball State, which was my mentor.
Yeah.
And he played for the Dolphins and the Bengals, a 6'6", 280, just jacked dude. But I had no idea who he was at the time, but he was the only strength coach in the whole city. And so John Torrine told me I need to go back to school. I applied. I got rejected. After I picked my soul up off the floor, I went back into admin at Ball State and was like, you know, hey, I know I got this letter of rejection, but I think it's a mistake. You need to let me into school. So they sent me in to talk to basically like the I don't know what they call it, like the dean of admissions or whatever. And the dean of admissions actually was working out at the YMCA and knew who I was. So if I would have never like – went and reapplied myself and showed him that I was serious, they'd have never let me into school. So I get there and he's like, hey, you look really familiar. I'm like, yeah, I'm the big strong kid that trains at the Y with Timmy. And he's like, oh yeah, I remember you. And he's like, well, what's the problem? I was like, well, I applied to go to school and I got rejected because my high school grades were too bad. So he pulls up my script and he looks at it and he goes, yeah, your high school grades weren't that great. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of told him the situation a little bit and that I was super into lifting and I went and talked to the Colts and this is the type of job I want, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, well, he goes, we let three or four people in it every semester that we see are outstanding in some other way other than our normal standards. And so he got me in on a probationary status. And then my first semester, I got like a 3.8 GPA, and I was off of that pretty much, right. You know, kind of like, you know, whatever you call a suspended list or whatever, you know, academic probation. But the point was, is the lifting is actually what got me into school and got me where I was, because if I wouldn't have been the strong kid that was at the Y that he kind of knew of, he would have never stuck his nose out to try to get me into school. And right. So I had Dr. Kramer and Dr. Volick and at the time, Dr. Costell and some of the forefathers of the NSCA were at Ball State at the time. I didn't even know.
Right.
And so I became really good friends with all of them, and they saw the passion that I had, and they fed it and got me into grad school. And, you know, everything else was kind of history. After I got out of grad school, I moved over to Ohio and started training with Louis. But I was already over there on the weekends squatting and deadlifting and benching because I didn't have anybody strong enough to train with me. I was already in grad school. I was already squatting 900 and benching close to 535 raw and pulling in the mid sevens. So I was the strongest guy ever from Indiana, let alone in my area. So it just made sense to go there. But I had two choices, and I don't know if I made the right one. But in 05, I could have went and trained with Louie, and then Ed Cohen wanted me to go train with him in Chicago. And sometimes I kind of wish I would have went to Chicago, but I was at the right place at the right time when Westside Barbell was kind of hitting it hot, because Chuck Vogelpool was still in his prime. George Albert was the one that taught me everything about the bench. Yeah. So there were a lot of legends that I was fortunate enough to get taught and get mentored under and all those types of things. So that kind of just set the standard for everything going the right way.
What an incredible story. I think it, you know, so much to dig in there. I think just the perseverance and the relatability of strength coaches, that, you know, every one of us from self-made athletes, or, you know, that's, we found our passion chasing that journey. But the thing that you mentioned that I think is probably the biggest takeaway to me is that law of the lid, right? You know, not knowing what your ceiling was, or seeing, or having it set so high that you just didn't know any better. I think so many times as coaches or as athletes, we look at that and we kind of set this low bar, you know, and then at a point we have a hard time kind of chasing or up that.
I think that in some ways that the old time strength coaches, because they had a passion for lifting weights and they were probably strong guys of themselves. Like one of the original strength coaches at the Colts was Dick Sapanzik. And Dick Sapanzik was known for being able to pick up the back of a car with his neck. So he had a special brace he could hook onto a bumper and pick up the back of a car. The point was, is he was a massively strong man. And the point is, I think that a lot of the kids and younger adults that come in to try to be strength coaches, I think they might do it because they like it, but they don't do it because it's passion. Like for me, somebody breaking PRs and excelling and pushing their limits is a passion. And I don't set ceiling limits on people because I never had a ceiling limit myself. And I think that a lot of people's strength coach limitation is that they're not around other insanely strong people. I mean, like, you know, I've always been around people that were breaking world records or doing things that were extraordinary. So when I see an athlete squat 500 pounds, for most people, like, wow, that's crazy. Or my fireman, and I'm like, dude, you're just touching the surface of what's possible.
Right.
You know, whereas an average person, if they see 500 on the bar, that's scary.
Yeah. You know? Well, I think, so, you know, aligning yourself with your passions, I mean, allows you to do things that you never thought were capable. You know, I mean, at one point in your life, you going to get a master's degree in biomechanics, learning from some of the best in the world and setting world records and things like that. You know, that was at one point in your life, I was probably like, nah, that's crazy. But when you're chasing your passion and you're surrounded by good people.
And I think it was always having the adversity and the always feeling like it was behind the eight ball. So what really got me into the gym, you know, I wasn't going to the gym initially to look for father figures after my dad passed away. I was hit by a car at 6 years old and put in a wheelchair for an entire year. So when seventh grade came along, that was the first year that you could actually play real football. And my upper body was always pretty big. I had pretty broad shoulders, but my legs were always behind because of the basically development that I didn't get from 6 to 7 because I was in a wheelchair. And so I knew that my legs had to get stronger, and being just a kind of goofy ass kid, I walk into the local YMCA and I'm thinking, well, squats and deadlifts and all that shit's got to fix it, you know? So right. I didn't really know per se, but the point was, is that, you know, in 15 years, starting my journey at say 13 or 12 and a half, just messing around with lifting weights, it took me 15 years to break my first world record. And that was 15 years of going to bed at 8:30 at night and not really having any kind of nightlife and not doing the normal party shit and right. college and really segmenting myself away from friends that didn't have similar goals. I had a really hard time when I was younger being around normal people. And I think that helped me a lot, but for some people, it just wasn't their lifestyle. I mean, if you weren't trying to exceed at crazy things, I didn't really have a lot of use for people. And yeah. that kept me very segmented away, and I had very limited friends, but the friends I did have were very, very useful as far as helping me get stronger and keeping me on the right track. Because, you know, at the time, Ball State was a massive party school. Yeah. We were ranked in the 90s. We were one of the top party schools in the country.
I remember that.
And yeah. Wade saw something special in me. We'll see him at Coach's Conference. I'll introduce you to him. He's a really nice guy. But, you know, he saw something in me and knew that I was willing to study and learn and push myself to the limits and try everything myself before I gave it to anybody else at the highest level. And I always felt like I never knew if I could ever be the best, you know, be the best strength coach or the best lifter or whatever. But I never wanted the regret of not trying as much as I could, you know. Yes. So for me, it was all about feeling like I had an opinion that mattered. You know, like if somebody asked me, hey, Matt, what do you think of this squat variation or what do you think of this or that? Everybody's going to have a slightly different opinion based on their experiences, but I just wanted my opinion to matter with the top level guys. That's all I cared about. Yeah. I just wanted my voice to be mean something, to have weight. And that's what pushed me, you know.
Well, I think it's incredible there. I mean, tons of learning from mistakes and having the right people around you to support you as an athlete. But what about as a coach? I mean, now you're coaching, you're working with people all around the world. You do a lot of work in our military, do a lot of work with first responders. What is one of the biggest mistakes you've made as a coach and how you've learned from it?
I think some of the big mistake is trying to figure out that people aren't me. Like, that's one of the biggest things I still fight with all the time. Like, I felt like I had the worst cards dealt. I had some of the worst, you know, injuries dealt to be able to squat world records and have strong legs and all this stuff. And I got guys that never had any of that adversity and they still don't want to push. And that to me is like the worst thing in the world. And I still have a difficult time dealing with it, you know? So a lot of the intense first responders that I train and a lot of the intense military guys that I train, we all get along great. And the guys that are subpar and average, I have a really hard time dealing with because they had better cards than I did. It's just for some reason, they just don't have the work ethic or any type of passion. And for me, you know, I think it's one thing to want to be strong, to break world records and to have notoriety or whatever you want to call it. But to me, especially with military and first responders, that being insanely strong and fit could be the difference between somebody living and dying. And sometimes I can't get through to those guys or they don't care. And that to me is one of the biggest, not mistakes, but things that I still need to work on as a coach is I have all the knowledge to get people better. Sometimes because of my adversities and pushing through stuff that normal people wouldn't push through, I don't have a lot of my tolerance level, especially as I've gotten older, my tolerance level has actually gotten worse for dealing with that because I feel like if firemen and EMS people are going to get paid close to 6 figures to protect people, then they need to be better than the average person. And the problem is a lot of them aren't. A lot of them aren't, and a lot of them don't care, and that's really sad.
Yeah, I echo that. I mean, I think you know, a lot of, obviously, the you know, special forces, I worked in special forces for a while. I mean, they're some of the most dedicated, incredible people you'll ever meet.
Yeah, and, to hit that point on you is – see, I got my first military taste with 3rd Battalion Rangers at Fort Benning. So I didn't have to worry about work ethic. Those guys were animals. So I'm thinking, well, shit, the whole Army's like this. Wrong. I'm thinking, oh, all firemen are like this. Wrong. You know, so It actually was a bad thing. I should have been set with shit bags right off the rip and then figured out how to get them motivated versus starting at the top of the chain and then realizing that motivation wasn't their issue. They just needed to train smarter, right? They need to take the energy that they had and put it in the right position versus dealing with people that have zero passion and zero energy. And that's really tough. That's why I'm slowly letting a lot of my people that work in my gym and the first responders I work with, I'm slowly becoming more of a director and less of a day-to-day operations guy because it's difficult. You know what I mean?
Not atypical of the wide receiver that I get in the NFL that it just is a great athlete that doesn't want to lift, you know? You got to find their motivations, and that's part of coaching. Is it's easy to work with the people that like to train.
Yeah,
coaching is actually training. You're working with the people that you're changing their life, and you're doing that on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think the biggest mistake for me was I felt like if I knew all the percentages and all the techniques of how to lift perfectly, and all the programming and periodization ideas or things that I had, that I would have all the tools I needed to get everybody better. And what I realized probably 5 or 8 years ago is that's only half. The other half is figuring out how to motivate unmotivated people. And that can be very difficult. And I think when you start, when I came from an area like the lifters that I was around at that time and multiple world record holders and guys like Kramer and, people like that, is that motivation was never a problem. So when I got thrown into a situation where motivation was an issue, it was a definite eye opener. So I think the biggest mistakes I made was not studying enough of how to motivate unmotivated people, I think.
I think that's something that all coaches to put at. It's the hard part because we didn't go to school for that, right? We went to school for the sets, reps, and the
science.
But we didn't
necessarily the science instead of the mentality,
I think that's 100% accurate. Are you over 40 now?
I'll be 40 this October.
Yes, almost 40 years old. You've got 3 world records. You're an elite athlete still to this day. How have you been able to do that in a sport that damages so many people? How have you been able to do that in a way that you've been able to stay healthy for a majority of your career?
Well, a lot of it was that I build up really, really slow. So people say, well, shit, Matt, you benched 500 in your teens. I started lifting when I was 12 and a half.
Yeah.
So by the time I was at the almost 20, I'd already been lifting for almost 7.5 years. So that's the thing is and like I told you earlier, my first world record didn't come till I was 28. That was almost 15 and a half years of busting my ass, So I was always in it for the long game. So I think the one big thing was that I realized that if I wanted to be super good, I was going to have to last a long time. Because right out of the gate, I was a national caliber good lifter, but I wasn't a world champion like a Ed Cohen. So I knew that at 6'1", and even though I was a big kid, that the deadlift was always going to be hard, and I was going to have to work a long time to get my back strong because of the leg issues and the pelvis issues, which still bother me a little to this day. I would say if I got gifted to anything would be the bench press. I trained it hard, but I learned perfect technique from a small kid. I never was allowed to do it wrong.
Right.
So I think the thing of it was I always put technique in front of intensity. I think that's what kept me in the game. I always looked at the long term, never the short term. I never looked at 12-week gains. So when I got ready for a meet, I might have goals that I want to hit at that meet, but those goals have already been set from last year. So my training cycles were so long because I would start with a goal from 8 months ago and they were always obtainable. So I benched 606, when I benched 606 in 14, it took me 1 year to go to 611. One entire year of sweat and tears because I was squatting a world record before I was benching that.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it's kind of being a great powerlifter is almost like being a triathlete because you got 3 different disciplines that, although they're lifting, they're very different in how they're built and what accentuates each other. The squat and the deadlift do have some, mirror objects of things that they can use to help. But in reality, they're a very different lever system. And if you're taller, the squat's going to be easier for you than the deadlift, depending on if you have bench press arms or not. So sure. for me to pull in the mid 800s was everything I had in the world. It was the hardest lift to get to come up because the bar is way over my crotch when I'm at locked out position. So the bar is having to pick up 3.5 feet off the ground. Yeah. Whereas you see these guys are like, you know, I'm not putting them down. They're putting in a lot sure. of work, but you see these, a lot of these 900 pound deadlifters right now, they're built to deadlift, which to yeah. me as a lifter that has all three is not that impressive, because if you can deadlift 900, but you only bench 350, you know, obviously go work your weak points. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the point is I think that I always played the long game. I always took it my time to get better. And I set very realistic goals that were slow and steady. And I learned that from Eddie as a kid. And I met Eddie when I was 14. And the biggest advice he gave me was when you're building a wall, put one brick down and build the whole thing in one day. You know? So my point is, you know, I just got a little bit better every year versus trying to get insanely better in one rip. You still there? I know our connection's getting messy, I think.
Yeah. I don't know if that's on my end or not.
There. I see you now. So.
Fading in and out a little bit.
Yeah. So sometimes once you get on here for more than a couple, 15, 20 minutes, get broke up a little bit. If this works better.
There we go.
Getting better. Doing all right?
Yeah. No, I think that's such
there
a...
There we go.
It goes back to kind of like that Malcolm Gladwell, you know, 10,000 hour rule. You know, I think, you know, you put so many hours in that you're... And it was so focused and the plan was worked throughout the entire process that it led to lots of success. So I think that's...
Yeah, exactly. So
the message.
I think the reason that you see all these issues with powerlifting is because everybody has a short game and nobody's in it for the long term. And that's where I think you see everybody get broke and everybody have injuries constantly. The only thing I ever did was I tore my groin in 2014 after squatting one of the world records. And I didn't do it while I was squatting. I was doing it actually on my first attempt on the deadlift. And a lot of it was because I was in Florida and I was from Ohio, and it was the right. 1st of March, and I wasn't used to the temperature, and so I didn't hydrate correctly. Yeah. So I was dehydrating and didn't know it, and probably if I would have had to play those games over again, I probably would have had, you know, at least my mom come with me, which is a nurse practitioner, and IV me back. But I just didn't realize, you know. So that was the only injury that I ever occurred, which is just, you know, whatever. It's just dehydration. But yeah, I mean, the big thing is just get a little bit stronger every cycle. Don't try to go to the moon in like, you know, a month or even a year, and just take your time getting better. And you'll find that your bones, your ligaments, your muscles, your tendons will all adapt to things in time. But if right. you try to push anything too fast, the body can't adapt to it. And it's going to just basically go into fight or flight. And that's when you end up having lots of injuries and mess ups. That's why you see a lot of these guys, especially nowadays, you see these guys that are 21 to 27, and then by the time they're 28 to 30, they're gone. Well, hell, I didn't even hit my peak until I was 35.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right. So
yeah, important. And so important.
So a lot of that came from Eddie as a kid.
Came from Ed Cohen, you said?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, came from Eddie Cohen, and you know, I watched how long he had his career, and then I was already friends with Mike O'Hearn. So I had talked to him quite a bit about what he went through in his 30s and 40s and what he had to modify and change. Same thing with Stan Efferding. I hold Stan Efferding at a very high rate because Stan semi-retired from bodybuilding in his late 30s, switched all the way over to powerlifting and broke world records in his 40s.
Wow.
And like to me, that's just impressive, and dealt with very minor injuries. And I think the one big thing that we had and we shared, if you talk to Eddie or me or Stan or Mike O'Hearn, is we never missed workouts. We just modified them based on different factors. You know, do we not feel good today, dude? Whatever. We adjusted things, but we never missed. So we always maintained consistency without having or increasing the injury process. So
yeah.
that's what makes it so impressive with me, that Michael Hearn and Stan were able to stay so lean year round and be that strong.
Yeah, those guys are incredible.
Yeah, unbelievable. You know, work ethic is just out of control.
You're old enough. I mean, we're about the same age. That, I mean, you remember the whole high intensity versus the world type of, you know, debates early in our careers. You know, with machines versus free weights and, you know, things along those lines. You know, obviously now, I mean, you know, you have a belt squat. You have, I think, a loaded hyper, some other machines that you've added in your own, you know, things that you're selling even. But in your gym, you have some machines. You know, if you go back to some of these powerlifters back in the day, if you said a machine, you could see the steam going out of their ears. You know, what I think it's a good topic for a guy like yourself. You know, where do you see the blend being?
Well, I think if you want to talk blending of equipment and non-equipment, I think you're probably, I'm one of the best variabilities to that. So the difference between having equipment is the fact that you can modify around tweaks and little pulls and how you feel. So I initially created my back extension machine, my standing good morning machine. I created that in case my shoulder or my hand or my elbow was tweaked or didn't feel good and I could still deadlift heavy.
Right.
And then over the years, making little small adjustments on that. The belt squat was designed specifically because as my bench got stronger, i.e. over 585 raw, my pecs and shoulders got to the point were so big. And I talked a lot with Bill Kazmaier about this. But I got to the point where I was so big that squatting with a straight bar every day or every week was going to start causing major shoulder problems. So I needed a way to get lots of volume in on squatting without damaging my shoulders more. And that was the biggest problem with being a full meat lifter versus just a squat guy, is I had to retain or be good at all three lifts and be able to rotate those movements. So having multiple equipment use in a smart fashion allows you to train around being good at three lifts or maybe athletic sports endeavors, things of that nature.
Right.
So the point is you got to have certain equipment. Now, at certain strength levels, you could probably get away with having very basic shit. But if you're compounding different athletic endeavors and or lifts that you want to be successful at or very good at, you're going to need a lot of tools in your toolbox to make it there without getting beat up.
I agree 100%. I mean, I did the whole, you know, I was working with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers where it was pure high intensity. I'd come from Istvan Javorek, which was complete weightlifting.
Yeah.
And, you know, went to the polar extremes. And what I found was that there's so much value in taking the good from everything and having that toolbox.
Yeah.
Because very rarely are you dealing with 100% athlete, or very rarely are you dealing with.
Yeah. And that's. The stronger you get, the more you push your body, the less you find optimal becomes an option in any way, shape, or form. You got to be able to rotate, modify, and change all the time. And I found that the belt squat allowed me to get 20, 30,000 pounds of extra volume per week on my legs and my hips without messing up my back or my pelvis, which was directly an issue from my childhood problems. I developed that for myself. And then what I started to realize is there were a lot of people in my boat for different reasons, neck issues, shoulder issues, back issues, that they weren't able to squat, or they weren't able to squat very often, and this allowed them and enabled them to do it. And the first person that really bid on it and used a lot with their athletes was Joe Kent at the Carolina Panthers.
Yeah.
He saw me using it a ton, and he's like, how is that helping you? I said, dude, I can get tons of leg volume, and my back feels amazing for deadlifting. And he's like, wow, that'd be really interesting for football. And I'm like, hell yeah, I would have like six of them for football, because these guys are getting impact injuries all the time. Their necks are messed up, their back's messed up, their shoulder, their elbow. Well, now you're not putting them in a straight bar anymore.
Right.
So he started to get more of those machines and started to realize the importance of them. And then the Chiefs caught on, and then the Eagles caught on, and now the Lakers have them. But the point is like, it just is a tool that allows you, if something's not right, to do a regular squat. You can do this, and you can still get a really good idea of what your normal squat is. So when I squatted 900 in just a belt in sleeves, I could only do like 8:35 for a triple on my machine and about broke my damn legs.
Really?
So it's close.
Yeah.
And then the girls that I have that can squat 300, they can do 225 for three or four on it. Well,
yeah.
If you saw somebody squat 225 for four and the fourth one was moderate, you're probably around a 300 max. So what I started finding out was that the belt squat ratio, not only when you weigh it, you know, if you pick it up on a deer scale, the machine weighs exactly what it says. So it's right. A 55-pound squat bar is what the frame weighs. And then whatever you put on, it's like a normal squat. It actually functions like that too. Now, if you use it all the time and you don't squat with a regular bar, fairly regular, then yeah, you're going to get better at a belt squat than a regular squat. But if right. used in conjunction with squatting, it allows you to have your volume crank to the moon without any overuse injuries.
I 100% agree. I think it's just so important. And like you said, I mean, just having the right tool in the toolbox when it's needed, is that's our job. Yep. That's our job as coaches.
Yep.
You know, yep. I alluded to it at the very beginning. I mean, it's hard to classify you. You know, you're this world-class athlete, you're a world-class coach, you're an entrepreneur, podcaster, author, you know, put on seminars.
Yeah.
All these different things. Talk a little bit about the importance of being an entrepreneur in the strength and conditioning space.
Well, I think that's what separates the big timers from the small timers in our business. The small timers, in my opinion, and I'm not saying that to be negative, but
sure.
the small timers are the people that don't realize what their true potentials are. They're afraid of risk. They want a steady paycheck. They're afraid to go out on their own and do their own thing because they want that $3,500 a month that they know they're going to get all the time. Well, when you sign contracts like that, it's going to say no compete clauses. You can't take those athletes and go train them at your facility.
Right.
Right. So I think Ken's one of the only guys that might have a situation where he works at the Panthers in the morning and then goes works at his own facility in the afternoon, which is awesome. But my point is that I think people are so cautious to not have security that they end up missing the big picture of all of the real rewards for our job, which is there is risk. I mean, I didn't make shit
right
from 26 to 33. I was grinding. I had a small facility. I didn't have a lot of overhead. I didn't have a lot of risk, but I didn't have a lot of reward. And what I started to realize was, you know, because I was able to take that jump and start my own facility and do my own thing, it opened up a whole nother door. But the risk right there was I didn't have a steady check for the first 10 years I had my gym where right. I was doing any of this business. It was, I'd make $2,500 one month and then make $4,500 the next month. You know, it was always so variable. And that's when I started to realize that maybe I needed my hand in multiple ventures. Yeah. So I needed to have a gym.
That helped.
That. And then I needed to go.
Yeah.
Right. And then I needed to go and outsource to work with fire departments. And then that helped. And then I needed to start building my own equipment because I saw the need for it. And that helped. Then I started writing manuals and doing online coaching. And that helped. So the point was, is now I have a steady income because I have five different things that are variable all the time.
Right.
Versus everybody thinks, well, you know, if I know my stuff and I go open up a facility, everybody will come to me. Well, I'm telling you, that's not the case.
Not the case.
You can know everything in the world. You could have the best location in somewhere in tropical, you know, Miami. But the problem is that you got to be willing to set your foot down and be in one place for 10 years before you see anything grow.
Right.
You cannot come out and go, well, man, I've been busting my ass for 6 months and I don't see any gains or I don't see any success. Dude, if you're waiting 6 months for success, you better times that by like 20.
Yeah, right.
Right? I mean, I think I'm just now getting to where my business is really successful and I'm damn near fucking 40 and I've been out of grad school for 15 years.
Right.
Now, I could have probably got there faster if I'd have got on social media quicker or if I would have not focused so much on lifting and being – a world record holder and just working on business, but then I wouldn't be who I was.
Yeah.
And I think those things come to you when you're ready for them. And if they come to you too soon because you did the wrong thing, eventually, you know, fate calls your bluff and gets your cards back.
Yeah.
You know? So if I had any advice would be open up, take risks, you know, especially if you don't have kids and you're not married and you don't have anything holding you down, take risks.
Yeah. It's the time to do it. You don't know anybody.
Take risks because you may not be in that position later and you have no clue of what's available unless you're out trying to work for it. I just found that being in multiple niches, I maybe some sort of OCD or whatever, not maybe ADD, but I like being in different categories of different things. I like focusing on equipment for a couple hours a day. I like helping people online coaching. I like going to my gym, but I wouldn't like being at my gym 12 hours a day.
Right. Yeah, I agree.
Right. I wouldn't like just working with my equipment. I wouldn't just like doing online coaching, but I like doing all of it.
Right.
And that's where I feel like I'm my best fit.
Yeah, I'm right there with you, man. I'm the exact same way. I think, I mean, your point of taking risk, I think that's something that all young strength coaches, y'all young strength professionals, they need to understand that.
Yeah.
I think what's coming with that is also taking action. When you learn something new, take immediate action.
Yeah.
You know, and ingrain it.
Yeah.
I think that's, you know, when you and I started getting into the entrepreneur space, that's what you did, is you learned something new and then you took action. And, you know, some things worked out, some things didn't. But
yeah.
having that diversity.
Yeah, that's the thing is you just got to be willing to
have that diversity.
You just got to be willing to pick up. Yeah. Yeah. And you just got to be willing to pick up and what's successful and what's not. And I think that's the biggest separation from guys that have the average jobs in our field and guys that have the excellent jobs. The guys that have excellent jobs are willing to be very, you know, educatedly risky,
right,
but not too insane, but be able to take some chances and be able to do things. I mean, I had no idea that starting an equipment side business would really take off. I just knew that what I made was better than everybody else.
Yeah.
Other than that, I just kind of took it out on a whim, and if it failed, it failed. Great, whatever. But the point is like, I think if I had to give any advice to anybody, I think what made me successful is I kept my overhead very low. I made me my product first before I tried to make everything else around me successful. I made me successful.
Right.
That in my opinion speaks volumes, because you're willing to put yourself in, you know, in the pen and get wild. And I think that really set me apart and helped me when I trained my NFL guys and stuff like that, is they looked at me and I go, dude, what you can do, I can do way better in this. So that to them was already, they're going to listen and they're going to try their hardest because the guy teaching them can do it. And it's not because I was genetically gifted or had everything set to me, or I used to be like a pro NFL guy. I just worked my ass off.
Right.
And they could see it. They could tell, you know what I mean? So keep a low overhead and, you know, go learn from people that are who you want to be. And just remember that sometimes you get what you pay for. It's like, we just started charging to do internships at the gym the last couple of years.
Right.
And what's funny is now that I charge for internships, I don't get shitty interns anymore.
That's right.
Like, and now I have interns that are TAs at like University of Kansas and going to these big places and getting assistantships with pro teams.
Right.
Because they're willing to put in their own time and effort and energy in something versus coming in just wanting a fucking handout.
Yep. I think it's so important. I think, you know, what you said there, making you your product. I think when you bet on yourself, if you're willing to put in the work, if you're gonna win at some point. You know, if you continually put in the work, and I think that's something that I respect so much about you, but also respect about people that do the same. Joe Ken, see Zach Evanesh is on. I mean, these are conversations that we have very regularly. Zach and I talk almost, you know, weekly about this type of stuff, and I think it's so important to have that heart of that explorer's heart, where you're trying to constantly challenge yourself to be uncomfortable, and part of being uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean, risk. I've never been comfortable. I've never been. Yeah, you're right. I've never been comfortable my whole life. I've always pushed myself out of my comfort zone, whether it be with school or my own lifting or my business, and I'm slowly reaping the rewards of it. But like I said, you know, I'm super strong now. My business is doing really well now, but it's taken me so long to get there that it's more of I'm a sit back and kind of breathing, but, you know, and kind of like just expelling and just like, ooh, you know, I finally made it. But
right.
The thing of it was, it took so long to get there that it's almost like now I have to work so hard because that's all I know. And I don't mind it.
Yeah,
it's just the point is, I think people, yeah, I mean, if you want to be somebody in this business, I think now is the point that you have to be able to walk it, talk it. You got to be able to explain it. You got to be able to be mentored and mentor others. You got to have the full package if you want to be the top level dude.
Great.
And I think a lot of people just put their energy in too much of one thing, and then they expect too much from it and don't realize that all the other factors are just as important.
Well, I talk about it on the show quite a bit about how this field is less than 100 years old still. It's also born from a time when people used to think it was bad to lift weights, and now people are making $500,000 doing it. And it was a generation of coaches and athletes that said, no, this works, and let me show you, and make opportunities.
Yep.
And too many times coaches want, like you said, have their hand out waiting for something to fall in their lap. And I don't know a single person that you've talked about, that I've talked about, that's got there just by somebody giving them a handout. And they've all worked extremely hard and still do to this day. So I thank you for saying that. And I think it's a message that most people need to hear.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, Matt, we end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you've received.
That I've received? Well, I think one of it was, you know, and it has a double-edged sword or double-sided coin to that is, you can write the best workout in the world, but if you don't bring the intensity to it, it doesn't matter.
Right.
So you have to bring a set of intensity to a workout. You can have the best written program in the world, but if you don't bring the intensity to it, it's not going to work. On the other end of that spectrum is that you have to be very careful at not just training like an idiot. You have to be very smart and calculated in what you do if you want longevity. I think that's why you don't see longevity in a lot of sports, is because there's a lot of smarts with a lot of the guys and what they're doing.
Right.
So, I think the biggest thing is like, and me and Michael Hearn, I mean, he kind of gave me the credit for it, but we never miss anything. We just modify.
Right.
I think that was one of the biggest things that I learned from O'Hearn, him being, 11 years older than me now, is that you always work around your adversities. You never fold into them. And that was probably a huge piece of advice for me, is that the people that are successful, it's not that they haven't fallen. They've probably fallen 1,000 times. They just keep getting back up.
Great message.
You know what I mean?
Great message.
Let's do a quick lightning, just quick answers. Some people that send in questions. Yeah. Joe Kidd asked if you'll ever compete in a lighter weight class.
Who asked that?
Joe Kidd.
Joe Kidd. Now, come on now. I've done almost 50 or 55 powerlifting meets. It's not that I don't love it. I've just kind of burned out of it, and I really like training for aesthetics right now. I mean, I still train powerlifting style.
Right.
Power building style, and I could, but I think the hardest part for me is I think once you've hit numbers that no human's ever done in a certain weight class, I don't think I would be satisfied going to a lighter weight class, because I would not be able to number.
Yeah,
and I think that would be, that's just hard for me. I felt like, I think the people that have issues with that are the ones that I felt like I gave everything in the world had. I pushed everything I had. I would bust my blood vessels open in my nose every squat workout to get ready for a meet. I would skin lift to make sure everything was perfect. I would, I gave everything I had to powerlifting for as long as I could, and I have some left, and what I think I left in the tank is enough for me to still enjoy working out. I think with the issues that would occur if I go to a lighter weight class and push, I'm just not willing to do the damage to the knees and the back. I want to just still enjoy lifting it in my 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I go to a lighter weight class, my competitive nature is going to push me to the point that I'm just going to get fucked up, and I really don't want to go to that point. So it's possible, but doubtful.
Yeah. Matt asked, quick answer, what's the difference between your belt squat and others that are on the market?
What's that now?
Matt Mitroni, I guess is his last name, asked, what is different about your belt squat versus others?
Well, the first big thing is the one-to-one ratio. So the machine has a very, very good transfer to a regular squat. The other ones are negligible. The next big thing that's huge compared to others is that Mine actually helps to teach you proper form. It has a spotter built into the machine and mechanism, so you can set it. That way, if you're training by yourself and alone, you can go heavy as hell, and you don't need five or six people standing around you.
Right.
You can get out of it yourself. That's a huge thing. And the other thing is there's no maintenance. That's the other big thing for coaches. We use elevator grain bearings on the damn thing that are meant to spin thousands of revolutions an hour, and it spins a quarter of a revolution every rep. And it never wears out. So you don't have cables or pulleys to replace. You have a built-in spotter, and you have a one-to-one ratio. There is no other machine on the market that attacks those areas. So for the people that want to get a belt squat, like I said, in my opinion, based on no maintenance, one-to-one ratio, and built-in spotters, there's just no machine like it.
Tate asked, do you use Bompa's max rep chart for max effort doubles and triples?
Bompa's chart is a good read, but I think that over time, Bompa's charts, if I remember correctly, were designed off of hockey and other sports. So their need for max effort training is going to be slightly different than powerlifting or guys that are highly advanced in lifting. So I always adapted and adjusted everything by feel. I wrote what I wanted to do, but I always had an adjustable mentality, and I think that's what kept me from getting injured too. But I think those particular charts and loading parameters are good to look at and good to get ideas from, but you're gonna, if you train long enough, you're gonna know when it feels like enough. And one big thing that I learned from Larry Pacifico as a kid, because he was from Dayton and I was from Indiana, which was really close, is that you always go to a nine, never a 10 in the gym, save a 10 for a meet.
Yeah.
So if you don't do meets, that's fine, but you probably don't want to actually go to a true 10 more than once or twice a year.
What a great, that's great advice.
Rob asked, he's getting into tactical strength conditioning. I think he's got an interview with a local fire department or something. Ask for what he needs to be prepared for working with tactical athletes.
He wants to work with them, or he's trying to be one?
He's trying to work with them.
Well, be ready for a lot of politics and bullshit. be ready for...
You've dealt with big army then, apparently, huh?
Being ready to adjust and vary your stuff, because what I noticed is when I go in and start with my first fire departments, I have to start 50 or 60% less than what I thought I was going to start with, even with beginners, because that's how out of shape and how injury prone they are. But the biggest thing that you could do, honestly, would be do an internship with me, watch what we do with the fire departments, watch how we deal with the fire department and tactical mentality. There's also other guys around the country that I have to think about. I think Verstegen does some stuff with tactical guys out of AP.
Yeah,
he would be another great place to go to as well. But the point is that really the tactical field, you know, we're talking about strength conditioning being less than 100 years old. In my opinion, the tactical field is less than 10 years old.
Yeah.
Maybe 15 tops. Now, there were guys lifting in the military in the 90s, but as far as tactical tacticians coming in and doing the right things, I was one of the first to train with the Rangers, and their shit was so ass backwards, it was unbelievable. It was like being time warp back to 1972, and I think even 72 they were doing smarter shit. but the point is that you're going to need to be around a lot of people that have been in that area and played with it. So I think you have to kind of be ready to write your own book and write your own rules and regulations, because even though, you know, NSCA has a TSAC, and I was pretty heavily involved in the tactical part of that NSCA branch off, they still can only teach the basics, and there's so much more to learn. You have to be almost mentored under somebody to see how it all functions.
Yeah, I think that's 100% right. I think working, you know, that's such a new space that you have you have to be in it to experience it, to know where to put it on and where to take it back, and understand the role of the job as well. That they're, you know, they're not the athlete prepping for a single beat. They're an athlete that could be in a life or death situation that night.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's another.
Yeah, so one of the big things like you're hitting on big time is you have to remember that you have to get these guys very strong, very slowly, and very injury-free, because you're dealing with a 30-year career.
Yeah.
You're not dealing with a 4-year military guy.
Right.
You're not dealing with a 6-year special forces contract or whatever. You're not dealing with an NFL guy that maybe you're not even signed next year.
Right.
You might only play one season. You're dealing with guys that are going to be on the job in insurance, either helpers or herders, for 30 years, which means your approach has to be steady and slow.
Yeah. Last question here we'll take from the group. Levi asks, Matt, when you're using a conjugate style program with athletes, would you recommend maxing them out with singles each week? Or would you go a different direction with the max effort day or would work with an athlete?
Well, what you're asking is a question that's too specific, and I'll tell you why. The first thing that conjugate, and this is where everybody fucks up, so pay attention if you're watching. Where everybody screws up about conjugate is they try to take conjugate and adapt it to the athlete.
Right.
Or the opposite way around. They take the athlete and adapt it to whatever system they're thinking. You take conjugate and you adapt it to the need of the person at that time. That's what makes it the most powerful ability to train someone, is conjugate is moldable to what you need. So for most people, they're going to need more muscle mass and more posterior chain, especially in posterior chain. And they're going to need more core strength, right?
Yep.
And they're going to need a vast variety of lifts as an athlete, because specific strength is generally worth shit.
Right.
So I've seen tons of guys that all they squat with is a straight bar on their back, put them in a safety bar and elevate their heels and they're trash. Take them and put them on a box squat, and they're trash.
Right.
Make them – they deadlift all the time with a straight bar. Put them with a fat bar and hook a double band onto it. Now they can't do it. Here's the point. If you want athletic strength that transfers over to tactical and athletes, they have to have a vast array and library of movements. But the smarts of that is you're picking the movements that are magnifying their weaknesses, not hiding them. Everybody wants to go in the gym and say, oh, I feel this exercise has made me feel really good. I look for the exercises that kick me in the nuts,
yeah,
that are hard, that say, you know, I can squat 800-900 pounds, but what if I could find a squat that would only make me do 250 or 350 because of the angle of it is so hard that it brings about all my weaknesses? That is the exercise that's going to make me stronger. So I think what you want to do is don't think so much taking the athlete and blending them to your need. Think about taking the conjugate system and blending it to the person's need. So if you're coming in, and back to that question specifically, and everybody needs muscle mass that you're dealing with, you're totally incorrect going singles.
Yeah.
They need fives and eights in their max efforts, because now they need time under tension and they need max efforts that have slower eccentrics, i.e. 3 counts and 5 counts down, so you're increasing the time under tension. You're still doing conjugate. You're just not doing singles.
Right.
So remember that if you're dealing with athletes that need muscle mass, they're going to need more volume. If you're dealing with athletes that are ultra-explosive and they can't gain any weight, then singles, doubles, and triples are going to be your best friend for your maxing, because you don't have any muscle mass to gain.
I agree with that 100%. 100%. Last question for me. With the show is a book, app, and website recommendation.
A book that I recommend?
Yep.
Okay. Well, the initial green copy of Zach Yorsky's Science and Practice of Strength Training is the ultimate book.
I love it.
I'm sure you got it back.
It's somewhere back there.
So that is a great book. And another book that's really good read, and I haven't read it in a long time, so I cannot really cite a lot from you for you, is The Science of Sports Training by Thomas Kurtz.
Yeah.
And what I liked about that book is the very front cover says that training is most efficient when you learn how to get the most from the least. And it may not say it exactly that way, but that's exactly what it means.
Right.
So what is that saying? Right. It's saying that if training is optimal, you're able to get massive results out of minimal work. But we all think, well, if we work more, we're going to get better. And that's not always true. Better is not better. Quality is better. So you have to remember that whatever you can train to optimally at this time based on your conditioning level, your strength level, that's what's going to work, not what you think is going to get you down the road in 10 years. You got to use what's going to work now. And I think that sometimes having a less is more thought pattern tends to create a very, very, very massive gain in strength and performance because you can recover from it.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Well, man, I truly appreciate you coming on the show. It took a while for us to make this happen, but
it's not that I didn't see it. It's just when I get somebody messaging me on something, it goes down 50 deep, and then I miss it. You know,
I'm right there with you, and I appreciate you taking the time and just I just appreciate the way that you've approached your career, the way that you're so willing to give back to the community. I think that's how we all get better. And I think it's, you know, it's like you said early on, I mean, the greats are the ones that are giving back, that are pushing the field forward, and they're unashamed about going after and taking risks, going after what they want. And,
yeah, exactly.
You embody that all the way through, man. So thanks so much.
Yeah, man, not a problem. I'm glad you guys we finally got to talk and go over some stuff.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate you, man.
All right. We'll take it easy, man.
You too, man. Talk to you later. I'll see you up there.
Later.
Indiana.
Yep.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey, on Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.